Hi everybody, this is Lisa. I know we're still getting set up. For those of you that are waiting, I just wanted to clarify. I do have some slides to work from today just to help our discussion if we want to use them. They came from a presentation, a keynote that I did last week on participatory learning. And the slideshow's unique in that there are a lot of interactive elements to encourage audience participation, but they don't work in Second Life. So if you're interested in kind of playing with it as I go through it, you would have to download that slideshow using the link that I just gave. And you can kind of run it in the background in PowerPoint while we're meeting today. And then if not, it doesn't matter. You can just sit and hang out with us today. But I just wanted to explain that. And then on the table, I put a gift bag, and you can either take a copy of the whole thing or just buy the contents. And inside is a copy of this slideshow, along with a couple of links, as reminders. So that's there on the table if you want to get a copy of it. Yeah, there are just some features built in the PowerPoint. If you click on certain pictures, and things will happen. And those features don't work. All of them don't work in SlideShare, just some of them. Annie, are we ready for me to begin? It's so cool to be here with you today. I'm sorry it took me so long to get to your class. This is actually one of my favorite classes that we offer, and my schedule's been so busy. So I really appreciate the opportunity just to come today and have a chat with you folks. Social networking is one of my huge passions because I think it has really, really huge implications for what's happening with the way learning is evolving globally. And when you combine it with virtual worlds, that's one of my favorite things. So this is a really good opportunity for me just to meet with you. So I think I'm going to go ahead if you don't mind. I'm just going to work off these slides. I may skip some. If there's key points in here that are of interest to you and you want to chat about, feel free to jump in on the mic or in chat, and we'll just go from there. And I, like I said, this was a keynote that I gave last week at a conference, and I thought, the title, I even struggled with the title, Let's Change the World. And I thought, well, that's kind of presumptuous, isn't it, to say that, who are we to change the world in education? And I think this is coming, from my belief, and I think you would all agree that the world is changing on a daily basis, right? And technologies are growing exponentially on a daily basis, and what we have access to. And so, a lot of times in online education, in particular, for years, online education, whether it's 2D or 3D, but especially 3D, has been made fun of in a lot of instances. And a lot of times we react to that as online educators or people in virtual worlds defending. So, the question that Imlani asked earlier, how do I, explain it to administrators? They just don't get it. And so I guess what I'm going to encourage you all to do as you, Mulani, thank you. As you move forward in your work, and trying to educate others about what you're doing here, that your work becomes proactive and that you don't necessarily have to be reactive. That we can be proactive and the world is changing, so why let the change happen to us? Can we instead use social networking and those types of learning opportunities to actually promote the change ourselves and to be on the leading edge of it instead of responding to it? And that's kind of and I'll be talking about that today in terms of how to create that with participatory culture. And okay, so let me get my little slides cooking here. And these may take a minute to res, so I apologize for that. When I did this session initially, I had this slide come up and it says this is a participatory session. And so simultaneously, I was running a Adobe Connect. It's basically a desktop video conferencing platform on another screen. And so for people that were in the audience that had wireless access, they could log into this chat room, and we had back chat running throughout the presentation. So people that were logged in, if I was talking, it was a way for people to record their thoughts and interact with each other in a back channel dialogue. And so this is one concept or one idea that I like, and actually for me it came from virtual worlds, is that we're always back chatting, right? Through either IM or the I'm sitting here talking to you right now, you know, in a little lecture format, and meanwhile there's a little back chat going on, or back channel chat going on. And so what I became fascinated with was, well, could you recreate this at a conference presentation? You know, we do it with Twitter now. We've got a lot of back channeling going on in Twitter, and could we do it in another way? And so I just set up an Adobe Connect classroom, and people logged in, and it also had a rating pod in it. So this was another idea I got from social networking. Could people rate me, or rate the talk as I went, or the key points in the talk? So I'm trying to promote participation and interaction through the dialogue. So even as I'm presenting information, can people rate it, interact with it, talk about it, etc.? So I'm going to encourage you all right now, again, keep the back channel chat going in local chat while we're talking today. This video, so if you click on this Welcome to the Revolution, how many of you have watched that video before? It's pretty powerful. It has some really powerful data. And that's on YouTube, and it's called The Social Revolution, if you want to look it up and run it in the background real quickly. You know, it really just talks about the impact that social media, oh good, is having on our lives, and with social networking becoming the number one activity on the web, overtaking porn. That in and of itself is a huge phenomenon. Facebook, if it were measured against populations of countries, it would be the fourth largest country in the world. Today I saw an article on Facebook as the new microeconomy for exchange of goods and currency. Because of the features and the way things can be monetized in the system. And so just trying to keep up with all of it can be overwhelming, like somebody mentioned, right? And every piece of it. So again, this idea, okay, let's keep participation going. So let me move on to our next slide. And this was, if you clicked on this, this was a movie clip, and I love integrating media into my stuff now. This was a movie clip from, I got it off of Hulu, and this was a Saturday Night Live episode where they were making fun of online education. And it was called like University of Westfield Online. And they were making fun of, I get to go to school in my pajamas. I can, you know, all the things that we actually like about online education. But in the commercial, what I found really funny was they showed a website, and the website had the school on it, and their little logo was Reinvent Yourself. And again, that was that idea, they're making fun of it, you know, how and how we market online education. And so what was funny about that was we were working on a brochure for our program at the same time that video came out, because I saw it on Saturday Night Live, and here's a screenshot of that. And guess what? Our brochure had Reinvent Yourself. So I went in to work the next day after I saw that on Saturday Night Live, and I said, hey, we have to scratch that brochure, you know. It's just too, it wasn't working for us, you know, to make fun of ourselves. And so sometimes in this, you know, idea of online programs, virtual world learning, we have to be able to make fun of ourselves, but at the same time not kind of perpetuate that idea of commercialism, low quality, et cetera, and instead move towards taking the lead. Have you guys seen the results of this study? This was over the U.S. Department of Education back in May released a report called Evidence-Based Practices of Online Learning. It was a landmark study in our field because they did a meta-analysis of over 1,000 empirical studies looking at the effectiveness of online learning compared to face-to-face. And the major finding, and I'll go to the next one, that they, yeah, it's huge for us, right? Because we've been fighting it. Oh, does it work? Is it effective? Oh, it's low quality. I'm not going to put my program online. I don't want to deal online. This was the major finding from the study, that on average, students in online learning conditions perform better than those receiving face-to-face classes. And they found that this proved to be true when the classes were also blended. So if the face-to-face was blended with an online learning component. And so for the very first time, we're in a position where it's easy to justify now that the U.S. Department of Education has put their stamp on online learning as being a good thing, better thing than just face-to-face. Okay, so the study comes out, right? So you can begin citing the study in your justifications for working with online programs, virtual world programs, etc. You will still run into naysayers who say it's impossible or that doesn't apply in my field. Well, not in medical, not in biotech, not in so that's the one extreme that you're going to run into, and that's going to go on for a while. People don't convert overnight just because, a meta-analysis comes out. And then you're going to have people on the other end of the spectrum. This is me. I admit it. I think I'm a computer geek. That have kind of known it for a long time now because of the powerful nature of the learning that's going on in our courses. And Nick, you were kind of talking about this, earlier. So these are some reasons what the report, if you dig into it, so it's like, okay, so it's more effective, but why? What's making online education more effective than face to face? And so here's four major pieces that the study talked about. One was learning time, the amount of time that people actually spend in learning because of the nature of the curriculum, the pedagogy that's being used, and the opportunities for collaboration. And so when I gave this slideshow, I clicked on this little picture to visit EdTech Island, and we actually brought them in to EdTech Island during the conference to kind of just demonstrate what does it look like when you have a curriculum in 3D or a 3D environment that you're working in. And I actually just demonstrated some of the pieces of EdTech Island and talked about some of the research that we've done here. I'm just looking at student persistence and creating, if learning time is important, how long people stay and interact is important, how do you promote that in the design of your teaching? How can you tell me in your experiences in this class, do you spend more time in this course than you have in other courses that weren't in virtual worlds? And if so, what's causing that? The back chat is a powerful tool, Annie. So you got that multiple streams of meaning making going on. So
I
Leslie, you're
can
talking
see
about
here.
the things to do outside of class. Nick, go ahead.
I just wanted to mention, I think students can fool themselves, especially if they're new to online learning. You really have to be a seasoned online learner, and if you can start an undergraduate work, it helps a great deal. It has a lot to do with time management.
Yes, it does. And we do a lot of work with K-12 online education and a lot of research around that. And we found that time management is actually the number one reported issue among online teachers, them learning to manage their own time. And it's the number one reported issue for students learning to manage their time and actually take responsibility for their work, log in, etc. And so now we're at a point where 2 years ago in the United States, we had about 500,000 kids that were taking one or more online courses a day as part of their curriculum. Does anybody know what that number's up to today? It's 2 million kids. So we went from 500,000 to 1 million. We doubled in a year, and then in the last year we went from 1 million to 2 million. We doubled again, and so kind of growing at that rate, you can see the exponential rate of growth in online education at all levels now. Let's see, that number just came out from, I believe it was a Sloan Foundation report. And if you're ever looking for any information regarding K-12 online education, go to that website, iNicole.org. It's an organization that's their focus. They send out lots of research reports, any news that comes out, grants, things like that. So they're just a policy and lobbying organization for K-12 online ed. One of the other findings from the study was that online learning, and this is true in virtual worlds too, so remember online is 2D and 3D, right? can be enhanced by giving learners control over their interactions with the media. So, and what if you click on this picture, what I had created here was a VoiceThread. And have you guys seen VoiceThread? It's a cool tool online. Basically, you have a static graph or graphic, and it can be anything, a picture, a JPEG of typing, whatever. And people can either leave written comments, audio comments, video comments, and the comments all show around the picture. And so you create this community dialogue around a picture, basically. It's called VoiceThread. And so just to come back of, right, giving the idea of giving learners control, when you can click on something, teleport somewhere, build something, the more interaction, you know, even something as simple as buying the contents of the bag here, right, or being able to download the PowerPoint and moving forward at your own pace, that's all giving you control over the media and enhances your learning experience. So I'm always thinking now, you know, and that was part of the design in this presentation. Again, if I'm giving a presentation to an audience, how can I give them control over it while I'm actually running the presentation? I'm still kind of playing with that idea. And I just did it for a live audience. Now, you know, now I'm thinking, okay, if I'm in a virtual world, how do I give you control so you can interact with the presentation? Okay, this was another finding from the study, that online learning can be enhanced by prompting learner reflection. Well, we've been doing reflection in teacher education for a long, long time. You know, it started with reflective journals and journaling, and the back graphic, so these pop in as separate graphics, is a rubric for discussion board post. So this would be a typical way in an online class that we might support reflection. You know, go post, you know, give feedback to two of your peers, use the rubric, etc. Then we kind of moved to blogs and blogging, as a way of owning your own work, right? And I can type my own words and you can give comments on it, but it's still my blog and I own that thinking, and I own that meta reflection on my own learning. And then the other picture that I have on here more recently, people are starting to use YouTube for reflection by working with the comments section, believe it or not. So if you click on this in the PowerPoint slideshow, it will lead you to Shireen Snelson's website. And Shireen Snelson is a faculty member at Boise State that teaches a class on YouTube for educators. And one of the things that she does in that course is tries to look at how to use YouTube to reach different levels in Bloom's taxonomy. And they actually create digital stories using playlists and by working with comments in the comment box to reflect on things. So this idea of learner reflection. Snowflake, that's a really important concept, that idea of not creating too much, well, if you want to use the word cognitive dissonance or just confusion, right? Too much too soon, too many tools, too many this, too many that. Some people are ready for it, and then other learners are still at the point of like, how do I log into class? And can be overwhelmed, right, when there are too many new technology tools all at once. So, Saw, I think your question's interesting. Which platform will emerge at the top? I don't think anyone will ever emerge at the top, and I think that's kind of the point now, that you've got this multiplicity of tools, and they'll always be evolving, and there'll always be one that's a little more predominant, and then as soon as that one takes predominance, some new one will come along with some new features that starts to overcome it. Clayton Christensen talks about that in the disruptive technologies. Hear that. Okay, I'm going to move on. So we're talking about this research report. Let's see if I've got any more points from it. No, I don't. So I don't know if you guys have been introduced to Henry Jenkins' work at all at MIT. He's got his whole new media literacies theory. And along with the new media literacies is this idea of participatory cultures. And so what he's saying is that media literacy, that today's kids are growing up creating, designing, building their own through social networks, creating new cultures and new ways of making meaning that they own. They don't need to wait for the teacher anymore. And one example of this, if you're a gamer, is that kids, adults too, will often participate in discussion forums. They have expertise in different areas. Some will know more about armor. Some will know more about trades crafting. There'll be whole communities built around these different facets of a game environment. And then people will set up guilds, and they have blogs and interactions and raids. And so we start developing these participatory cultures in different ways, or kids do. In particular, this is kind of an audience that I've been looking at lately, but adults do as well. And so if I asked you to think about, do you belong to a participatory culture online, a recipe club, a blogging community? Facebook is a form of participatory culture, where you're interacting socially, sharing knowledge, creating your own knowledge. Do you have any examples of that that you do personally? RP communities, yeah. A role-playing community, Leslie, good. Mermaids of SL. Doesn't get any more role-play than being a mermaid, does it? Facebook. And so this is if you click on this, this is a video, and Henry Jenkins just explains a little bit more about participatory cultures. And so you can watch that in the background if you're interested in it. Moodle can be a social network, and it's designed as, that's a great point, as a social networking platform, learning management system. WordPress, keeping a blog. And so Snowflake, I would say they're not the same. A social network and a participatory culture is not the same. In my mind, and this is just a limited definition, a social network is the tool, right? So if it's Facebook as the tool, for example, and the people, that's a social network. The participatory culture is what happens there. It's the people joining together to create, to produce. And it's usually in the form of, there's some form of artistic expression, whether it's you're building something in Second Life, for example, which I would consider artistic, or you're blogging and writing. You know, that's artistic. It's you working in community, putting yourself out there and creating something new that didn't exist before. That image chef, just creating, you know, multimedia posters, things like that. Yeah, so 531, if you're actually coming together to work on things, build things, create things. So there's an action piece to participatory culture. It's not just coming together to chat. And it also will typically involve mentors and students and this open sharing. And sometimes the mentor can be a young person teaching older people about things. And that can often be true in gaming environments where, you know, I participated in things, and some of the people that taught me were teenagers. You know, I used to play World of Warcraft and participate in that whole scene. Okay, so here are the two, participatory culture, and they came up with these new media literacies, you know. So if you're in our participatory culture and you're learning that way, right, it's very informal learning, there are these skills that go along with that. Well, I'm quite fascinated, how can we support those skills in Second Life or online through our social networking activities. And so these are the 12 skills here, and I'll just keep going on those. And the first one is play. And have you guys been to the Vincent van Gogh Museum here in Second Life? And so when you click on this picture in the slideshow, it opens up a video. It's an amazing video by Robbie Dingo, who built a Vincent van Gogh sim, or it was painting, but he built it out in 3D, and it takes you through that whole process. And so one of the things that, you know, I was looking at in that video, I was looking at somebody, okay, he took a 2D painting, and he not only had to you know, think about how to build that in 3D, which involved mathematics, knowledge of architecture, knowledge of building skills in Second Life. He had to have some type of artistic interpretation going on. But then he created a video on top of it and layered music on top of that, required video editing skills. And so this idea that he played with his surroundings in the virtual world as a form of how to problem solve. How do I make this 2D painting turn into 3D? And it's a pretty cool performance. You guys know about performance in Second Life. It's all over the place. Playing music in theater, role-playing, adopting alternative identities. So, Leslie, your mermaid activities. That I don't know if you can see that picture on the left, Miss Kelly's School of Dance. That was actually one of my, that's me. And I had started setting up a school of dance so we could learn about dances from different eras. And so it was more just fun, just people that were interested in period dance. And that's just something, an interest of mine. Yeah, so SL really lends itself to performance. Okay, one of the next new media literacies, one of the skills, simulation, ability to interpret and construct dynamic models of real world processes. And there's a lot of simulations in Second Life. Can you name one that you've been to that you really like a lot? So simulation is something that you would experience that simulates real life, where you can have a similar experience to something. Yeah, Snowflake, have you been to some nursing sims, like some medical simulations where you can work on the patient and take blood pressure and stuff like that? Rafting. Yeah, they don't let you fly to Mars, right. Go to a space station. Hallucinations, right. That simulation from a virtual hallucination. Sims. There's one called Second China. That one of our faculty worked on, where it trains you how to do business in China. So when you walk in, you're greeted and you're given the right clothing to wear, and then a note card, and then you're given a gift, because you have to give a gift as part of business meetings. And then you enter a conference room and they talk to you about where to sit at the table, because there's certain places you would sit and to have a seat. And if you don't sit in the right seat, you get penalized. You get bumped from it. Okay, the next new media literacy. I don't want to take up too much time going through these, so I'll do these really quick. Appropriation, ability to meaningful sample and remix media content. So again, we're back to that idea of giving the learner control over the media. This is a Glog, and to do Glogs, you go to Glogster, I think it's glogster.com, and down at the bottom there's a link. They even have them for education. So this is a multimedia poster. It's one page on the web. It's all drag and drop. You know, for inserting things in. And when you click on anything in this poster, it'll do something. It'll either play an audio file, move, play a video, things flip around. And so it's just it's a nice way to synthesize, for students to synthesize their knowledge. It's not like Prezi. It doesn't move. It's one static web page, but the items on it can be chosen by the students and inserted. And they can record voiceovers and things like that. And so things happen as you mouse over or click on things on the poster. Multitasking. So who was it? Was it Saw that had the question about how do you filter the information? How do I get focused on the salient details that I need to get the job done? Yeah, so they address it here, you know, this idea of how do we multitask and how can you scan your environment and shift your focus as needed to salient details. One of the examples that I gave was this game, and if you click on that picture, it takes you to it's a video, it's a trailer of, it's a 3D game, but it's not a game. It's designed to teach American history online. And so by completing the game, this is done by Florida Virtual School, which is a K-12 online program for kids. And if you go through this 3D game with your friends, by the time you're done, you will have completed 12th grade American history. And you will receive high school credit for that. And so it's the first game that I know of in 3D. And the reason I gave it as an example for how to scan the environment and multitask is the gaming environment itself. I like the way that games are set up with challenges and specific objectives and questing, things like that. And so you're always on a mission, right? I got to get the next whatever piece of information, the next clue, the next whatever, and I've got to work my way through the environment to work towards that outcome. And the environment is designed with supports that give you the clues. So, you know, if you're in World of Warcraft, for example, you know, you may click on a non-player character and he'll give you some feedback that gives you a clue, or you may get a piece of information in your inbox. And so I think games themselves are, this is why games are becoming so popular, or online games, for educational purposes, is that they can be crafted or designed to help provide that focus when it's needed by students. Right now I think it's one of the issues in Second Life for a lot of learners is they don't know where to go, what to do, how do I find the information I need. That takes a lot of training because the cues aren't built in the system for the learner. And so that's part of that orientation that they've designed. You know, those are part of the cues that they've built in to multitask. Okay, distributed cognition. Just working with tools that expand your mental capabilities. You know, mobile learning's the next big thing coming up, right? The little computer that we keep in our pocket that we've always thought of as just a telephone, you know, is really going to change our lives as we know it, and is already starting to. Just so you know, I don't think we've advertised it yet, but we have a class coming out this summer on mobile learning. It's a brand new class. But to participate in the class, you have to have an iPhone, unfortunately. So the entire course is taught on the iPhone. And so we're just looking at that and kind of exploring it. The idea of mobile learning, what does it mean to learn mobily and be able to access information and interact with your teachers and your peers, you know, using this small little interface that you can carry in your pocket. Collective intelligence, and this was an example from Annie, I think, weren't you in this class? When we had an assignment, and it was teaching and learning in Second Life, the first time I taught it, where I just asked every student to come up with one challenge and one solution. And Leslie, you were there too, for teaching in Second Life. Like, what's one challenge and one solution? And then everybody come up with one and answer it, and then we're going to combine those into a paper. And then we're going to take that paper and we're going to send it out on a listserv out to the public. So that was the assignment. And this is the idea of collective intelligence, that we all work together on pieces, combine it, and then we share that knowledge back out towards this idea of a common goal. And the common goal was improving teaching in Second Life. And so what I found fascinating, about the results of what happened with this, you know, so we sent it out over the Second Life listserv. And as a result of that, New Media Consortium invited the people that wrote the paper to come and do presentations over 2 days in one of their, what was that session called? A teacher, what were those called? I can't remember the name. And so not only did the students then have the opportunity to become the authority at that point, so it wasn't me. And I purposely didn't want to be at their presentations. And I know that sounds weird, but I was trying to pass on that ownership of the course at that point. This was towards the end of the class. And I felt like it was important for each student in the class to have the opportunity to say, this is the expertise I gained during the course, or one of the pieces of things that I gained that I can share back out with other educators. And then it got blogged about, which then shared the information yet again with people. So I really like this idea of collective intelligence working together towards a common goal, because it's viral and it affects people, you know, on and on and on. I think SL is viral in some ways, Snowflake, or can be used as part of a viral network. Yeah, we would like everything to be free, especially in education. And, you know, I'm a big supporter of open source content and free education. And at some point, though, everything that we do as educators requires our time. And so ultimately, you know, to live in today's society, you have to be paid. And so where does that money come from then? Where's the burden of that payment? You know, is it always on the government to make that payment? Is it on the student? And so we can say it should be free, but free is not real. That's because people can't just keep working for free. We all have to eat. And so who's paying then, if it's not the student, is the question, I think. Judgment, ability to evaluate reliability and credibility of different information sources. Wikipedia is a great example of that. I got a website yesterday that was, it was a map of the United States, an interactive map that showed where the states were and different report card features in education. And they were touting things like new models of teacher education, and they were all commercial-based projects. And they were like, you know, they were dissing colleges of education and, you know, all traditional forms. And it's like, hey, wait a minute, who's, you know, so I went behind the scenes and I was looking at like who actually put out the website. And they said they were a lobbying organization for corporations and businesses supporting education. So it's like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. They're going to you know, diss all the governmental things because they're trying to get, you know, the corporate side of their business sold. But that idea of judging, evaluating. Transmedia navigation, ability to follow the flow of stories and information. Leslie, you're in this picture. Do you see yourself? This was a fireside chat with David Gibson one night in class. And this is just an example of transmedia navigation where we started out as a class and we were talking about different sim types. Then we went out and actually visited different sims. Everybody kind of went out on their own and explored these sims for different reasons. They were given some prompts and questions. And then we came back and had this fireside chat with David leading it, sharing his information, and us kind of processing the experiences we just had in that larger context. And so this is this idea of being able to follow flow of stories and information. And Saw, I think this goes back to your thing of how do we focus on the relevant pieces. I think Henry Jenkins would say it's a skill you develop over time through experience with that. Guided experiences that the teacher can create in the classroom. Visualization. Have you guys seen Maya Realities data for Second Life? Have you ever seen any of that displayed? This whole island that you're sitting on is tied to Maya Realities. We have sensors buried in the land, and those sensors collect data, and the data just shows us who's walking where and how long they stay there. And so it creates heat map data. It shows what countries people are logging in from, what time of day is most popular, how many unique avatars come on the island each week. And so it's almost like site statistics, you know, that you would run for a website, except it's site statistics for a virtual environment. And so we use this data to actually understand lost what. Yeah, so we've been able to actually learn a lot about that data, and that's part of the data that we collected to study persistence on the island. How many, I'll throw out a question since you guys hang out on EdTech Island sometimes. How many unique avatars do you think come to EdTech in an average week? You'd be really surprised to learn that the average each week is about 500. Yeah, and the average amount of time that a person actually sits in the island. So, you know, if you think about a website, you know, 75% of people leave in the first 30 seconds. And so, you know, I got kind of fascinated with, well, if people are teleporting in a 3D world, how long will they stay? Will they leave in the first 30 seconds, or do they stay a little longer to explore? The average, what do you think the average time is? So if somebody's logging in, how long do you think they're going to stay in an average visit? I'm really surprised to learn that the average time here on EdTech Island is over an hour per avatar per week. You get some people, and I think it's the builders hanging out in the sandbox, that are here for like 2, 3, 4 hours working on projects, or students attending class. So anyway, this idea of visualization and visualizing your data and finding patterns and identifying trends and then taking actions because of it in your teaching or your design. This is the idea of respecting multiple perspectives, grasping and following alternative norms. And so maybe this was, Alani, this is kind of part of what you're dealing with that administrative, trying to help. This was a class where Sarah Robbins came to visit us and gave us a skin to put on to get rid of our gender, to get rid of our look. And then I think she asked us to take off our titles. And so that was just a discussion that we were having about what happens when you strip people of their identities in a learning environment, when you don't have a professor who's the authority and you can't tell really who's who. You know, you just have avatar names. You don't even know if it's male or female necessarily. And so this idea of exploring our identities and how we can easily do that in virtual world environments as a way to develop respect and appreciation for alternative perspectives. If you have the opportunity, this is probably the most powerful video in this whole slideshow. And believe it or not, it's a video of a study done by two guys, Christakis and Fowler, who've recently written a book. And they, on this topic of networking, which is really where my heart is, and so this idea of how do we search, synthesize, and disseminate information, what Christakis and Fowler did was a study of obesity, believe it or not. It was a look at 30 years of data. And so they tracked this data longitudinally over 30 years, plugged it all into their database. But what was fascinating about the data set was it had linkages. So it showed who was married to who, whose were who parents, friends of friends, etc. So they were able to actually create social linkages in the data set. Well, when you click on this video, what it shows you is how over the 30 years, obesity increased in relation to your proximity of people that were around you. So for example, they found that if your husband or someone very close to you, one step away in the network, became obese, your chances of becoming obese raised by 150%. If that person was two steps away from you, so let's say your husband's sister, your chances of becoming obese still increase, but by a less percentage, maybe 50-something percent. And so this video was really powerful for me because they also, once they got that data and they started understanding that people cluster in networks, and when you start clustering, people around you pick up traits just like you. And so they took that understanding and they applied it to Facebook. And they started looking at modern social networks. And what they did was look at people's pictures in Facebook and whether they were smiling or not smiling. And what they found was the same exact thing, that people who didn't smile tended to hang out with other people who didn't smile, and vice versa. So they said happiness. If you're affiliated or talking to or directly connected to friends that have smiling faces, you're more likely to be a smiling person. And so I'm quite fascinated by this idea that the networks that we associate in, whether they're virtual world networks or online networks or real life networks, that we as individuals can be heavily influenced by them, and that we tend to hang out. We become like the people we hang out with, and they become like us, that we share common features. And this is now shown true over other things besides personality traits, obesity, different lifestyles, different characteristics and traits like that. Okay, so keep this in mind, this idea of networks, and that effects of networks can go viral. So what started, these little dots that started out as little dots, yellow dots of obesity, grew over time as the network grew and the linkages grew. Suicide. People who commit suicide are more depressed, are more likely to get to hang out with others that are that way as well. Is that your point, Breeze? So a little more on networking. And so networking's been going on since the dawn of mankind, right? It's not new. You know, network. We've always networked as human beings. And so, you know, what is new, you know, are the technologies have changed. And so if we come up to a little more modern times, this is actually me. I just did this for fun. This was part of my talk just to get a laugh. This is a picture of me that I put in a Facebook yourself. So it makes you look like a picture of it, not Facebook, yearbook yourself. It'll put you in a different era, 60s, 70s, 80s. It's kind of funny. So anyway, my point was on the next slide that back, you know, when I was in school as a kid, we didn't have computers, and I'll admit that. And that we often networked on this way. And if you see the picture rezzing, it's by passing notes, right? And that's a form of networking. And so this is back before we had cell phones and texting and Facebook and all the little things that we do. And so the effect, or the viral nature of the network, the impact, was a lot slower. Things moved a lot slower. But now we're in a place where we have, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of different types of networks that we have the potential to participate in. And so you can see some of these networks here on this slide. And so you have to think back to that Framingham obesity study. If our networks have increased, if our linkages have increased, you know, what does that mean in terms of the impact that we can have globally? That our knowledge and that our sharing. So this comes back to my idea of let's change the world, and working with social networks to leverage that, and how to choose. This was from the paper, if you guys read the publication that I did on social network knowledge construction. These are some of the networks in and around Second Life. The green circle is Second Life, and there are in-world communication mechanisms or networks. And, you know, like the EdTech community group is one of them. Group chat is another form. Newsletters, conferences, these are all types of communication mechanisms. And then there are out-of-world mechanisms that interface with Second Life, right? Like the Second Life listserv, blogs about Second Life, wikis, etc. So the idea is that virtual worlds don't exist in a vacuum, that they're networked with all of these other tools. So you don't even have to be in a virtual world to be impacted by one. So for example, somebody who has nothing to do with virtual worlds might visit a blog where they're discussed and pick up knowledge from that. Here's some examples, again, of networks. EdTech Community Group, I think, is up to 1,500 members now. These are different presentations that have happened on EdTech Island. We've had a lot of presentations. Presentations are networked. The people come to the site, they take the information, and they leave, and then they go do something with it. So if you can even think about the island itself, the physical space, as being a form of social network. I can send an email to my friend without ever leaving Second Life. I can blog without leaving Second Life. Formal and informal social events are forms of networking in virtual worlds. So whether you're just hanging out on a patio talking to your friends, if you're on a virtual field trip, if you're having a back-to-school dance, these are all forms of and opportunities for networking. Sparkle. Oh, and then my another big point about networking is teaching people how to build in virtual worlds. It's an opportunity to, when you can build your knowledge. So, you know, if I say Nick or Saeed or, you know, Rowan, if I say to you guys, okay, this week you're going to go out and you're going to build blank to represent your understanding of this week's topic, and then you're going to leave it in an exhibit to share with others. So all of a sudden you've taken your knowledge and you put it in a 3D form, and now other people can come and learn from that. That is a really powerful form of networking in Second Life. In the paper also was a matrix, and that's the slide that's popping up now. This is a matrix for how to do that. So Snowflake, you said, how do we do that? How do we, you know, and this comes back to, how do we get a focus on the networks? How do we keep our students focused? And so what I've come up with and I'm working with now is a framework for thinking about, okay, how do we teach our students to leverage these networks? And basically, I'm working through 5 steps. And I designed my curriculum in the class around these steps. And so one is just identifying the networks. And this framework works whether you're in virtual worlds or just in other social networks. So, for example, if you're teaching science, Leslie, let's do you, mathematics. One of the goals would just be working with your students, what are the social networks in mathematics that apply to us that we can use in this course? That would be step one, week one. Let's go out and identify those, and let's come back and share them. Lurking, or just observing. So this idea that you would then enter the appropriate networks and just observe the culture. How do people talk? What do they talk about there? What are the norms of the community, etc.? Third step, contributing, beginning to offer up your contributions and ideas, right? So if you're on a listserv, sharing your contributions, a thought you have, a link maybe that somebody might help someone. That fourth stage is learning to create. Second Life, that would be building a plot or a sim or an exhibit, or what else could you create in Second Life? A walkthrough tutorial, an interactive simulation. There's a lot that can be created, so it's very powerful high-level learning. And then finally, leading networks would be the highest level of social network engagement, when you actually establish your own network that you then lead, that others participate in and contribute to. And so an example of that would be, for example, me just starting the EdTech community and people joining that and working with that over the last couple of years. And so this is a framework, and I'm calling it a pedagogical framework. And Castronova says that to be credible in networks, that you have to develop, well, especially in virtual worlds, this idea of avatar capital, or your capital in the networks, your value. And you only do that through contributions and creating and leading. And so I was looking for a framework that helped people develop this avatar capital. And it doesn't have to be avatar, it's just your capital in the network. Yeah, and that's in the paper Snowflake if you want to take that with you. This is EdTech Island back in January 2007. Basically, when I came in, it was just a flat piece of land with nothing going on. And so I was kind of faced with basically just, you know, trying to wonder as a teacher, what do you do in a virtual world when there's nothing there? And how do you build it? And this was my question that I followed. And how do you promote networking and learning, etc.? And you can see some of the stats here. As of this spring, we'll have taught 12 graduate courses here, generated over $200,000 in tuition. So again, that idea of how do you convince administrators? Administrators need data. So what data do you have? It's data like this. This was 450 visitors. Then that was back in September. Guest speaker events. We've hosted homes to over 50 international educators. Our group's up to 1,500 members. So whenever we need to send out a notice, that goes out to 1,500 members. How many people do those forward that notice? We don't even know. So there's a viral effect, right, when you've got a community group set up like that. But the island next to us called Cave is an island that we're sponsoring. It's a new partnership between Boise State, AACT, which is our accrediting organization, iNACL, and ARVLSIG, which is a research SIG for special interest group for virtual worlds. And so this is our next level of networking, is starting to work with professional organizations that we can expose our students to and get them memberships to. And that's actually coming next in the program. We're working on agreements right now to provide free memberships to these organizations for our students. And so again, these are the words around here, and you can't read them. They're kind of buried by these bubbles, is this idea of the five stages in social network knowledge construction that we identify, lurk, contribute, create, and lead. And by doing that, by leading our students through those opportunities in a circular process, we're taking it viral. The learning is going viral because they're sharing their knowledge in networks, and then teachers are picking that up and sharing that out in their networks, and eventually you're expanding your contributions, you know, in this larger global network. And there are many examples that I have of how this has actually impacted my own work. I'm wondering if you all, and I'll give you one for example, we set up some educators in the condo in Finland, or on a tech island, who live in Finland. And because of that, we started collaborating with them. I got invited to come to Finland to give a talk. While I was there, I met a professor from Texas A&M. He and I started working on a project, and now that professor is referring students to be in Leslie's teaching mathematics class because he's a mathematics professor. So the circles come full swing.